Hello and welcome to episode 12 of the Defensive Security Podcast. My name is Jerry Bell, and today is March 24th, 2013. As always, the thoughts and opinions I express on this podcast are mine and do not represent those of my employer. Well, it's been a bit of a busy week, and I am relaxing here before another busy Monday starts in the morning. I've got my Grey Goose and Simply Lemonade getting me properly intoxicated for the podcast. And I certainly do hope there are no more South Korea-type incidents this coming week, because, you know, my liver can't handle it. So anyway, let's get into the stories. First up is an interesting story by or about Cisco. Cisco released a new revision of its password standard or password storage standard. And in the process, they inadvertently weakened pretty dramatically the security of their password hashes. Previously, they were using MD5 with a SALT in 1,000 iterations. So basically, they added a bit of random data and ran the MD5 1,000 times. And the net effect there is, you know, it takes a lot longer, even though MD5 is a very optimized and fast algorithm. When you start having to run it 1,000 times, you know, it becomes a little more computationally intensive. The other thing that's important is the SALT. Each individual password entry has a unique SALT. And so what that does is makes it so that, number one, rainbow tables are rendered totally useless. Although I will tell you, generally, if you are using multiple iterations, you're probably not going to find a ready-made rainbow table for your case anyway. But the major advantage behind the SALT is that each individual password entry has to be brute-forced uniquely. So if you have, a password table that contains 100 or 1,000 entries, you have to brute force each one of those passwords uniquely using random SALT. Now, granted, you know what the SALT is, but the SALT is different for each entry. And so if you have a very fast system, you can't just continually scan through all of the password entries or the hash passwords in the set that you're trying to brute force. You have to actually take each one individually and run your entire dictionary or what have you against each individual entry. So that takes a lot more time. But what Cisco did was move to the PBKDF2 standard, which generally is a very good thing. However, somehow they managed to really screw up the implementation. And what they did was they certainly improved the situation by moving from MD5 to SHA-256, but they only ran one iteration and they used no SALT. And so basically what that means is that passwords encrypted with this, or passwords, I should say, passwords hashed with this new function are easily located in rainbow tables, and they're also susceptible to, as I described, a brute force attack where you can iterate through your dictionary and scan against the entire table of passwords. So if you're making improvements in the name of better security, which is a good thing and definitely should be encouraged, just make sure that you're implementing the changes as they're intended to be. You know, the devil is often in the details when it comes to security, and it is usually worthwhile to have someone knowledgeable looking over your shoulder, making sure you don't make the simple mistakes like this. You know, again, Cisco has taken a lot of heat for this mistake, and I'm not here to pile on to Cisco because I think they were intending to do the right thing, and I definitely think that should be encouraged, as I said, but more from a general awareness standpoint about how these kinds of problems can arise, I think it's important to highlight this kind of an issue. So, and hopefully we can learn from this kind of mistake. Okay, the next story comes from Etsy. And Etsy is a arts and crafts online seller. Basically, it's I equate it to eBay for the arts and crafts type people, where you can post your wares for sale. They actually have, a track record of being pretty responsible from a security perspective. And this week they posted some information about how they, in particular, have been handling the Java problems. So similar to what we've described in the past couple of weeks related to Java, Etsy does not allow Java to run on their workstations. They have some sort of a workstation management tool or application whitelisting that they use to block the running and installation of Java. But they're aware that their user base does have some valid needs for Java in their business. So what they've done is set up a virtual desktop infrastructure using Linux in a fairly lightweight remote desktop protocol. The way they've got things architected, it's easy for them to recycle the Java Unix systems, plus they can firewall it off, only allow it to talk to internal applications or to the specific external sites that they want. That way they can dramatically reduce the exposure that Java has on their business. There's a pretty good write-up by the Etsy team, and I've included a link to that in the show notes for episode 12. Now moving on to what I would say is definitely the headline for the past week, which was the attack against South Korea. Now, I suspect most people are pretty aware of the situation, but just to recap, last week around 2 o'clock on March 20th, somewhere around 30 to 35,000 computers in South Korea belonging to about 6 or 7 different companies, mostly either media outlets or banks, were completely wiped clean. There's been quite a bit of confusion and a lot of analysis being done online, and I'll just kind of recap some of the things that I've read about the malware. The first thing is that the symptoms are that the Windows PC, after it's infected, it no longer boots. So when you restart the system, you basically get a operating system not found type of error. So some researchers have gotten a hold of samples of the virus, and it appears to be similar to the Shamoon virus that impacted Saudi Aramco last year. So it's a wiper class of virus. Now, interestingly, I guess in this case, we don't really know how this virus propagated. So we don't know if it came in via email or through a watering hole, or if it was propagated by some kind of network vulnerability or other network type transport. It certainly does seem like it impacted quite a few systems. Although, honestly, this could have been building for quite some time. It does appear that once the system was infected, it scheduled a batch job to start at 2 o'clock on March 20th. So obviously, these systems could have been infected months or weeks prior to this date. But the virus gets in there. It overwrites the boot record. It overwrites the partition table and the backup partition table, and really just hoses the system up pretty good. The characters that it overwrites the boot sector with actually refer back to some ancient names of Roman light infantry groups. Now, as far as I can tell, there are about 3 different variants, and apparently the dropper, in addition to executing this payload that wipes the drive, it also checks for the existence of a couple of different SSH terminal applications like PuTTY, Secure CRT, and mRemote, and it looks to see if there are any stored profiles that have root access to any system, and if those have cached passwords stored. And if it finds any, it connects and uploads a script and runs a script that basically also deletes the drive of the Unix system it was connected to. And it has, from what I recall on the McAfee site, it had code for Linux, HPUX, AIX, and I think there may have been one more. So I've been doing this job for quite some time, and I can't ever really recall that kind of thing before, where a Windows virus, before it does its thing, it tries to reach out and connect to some fundamentally different system, like a Unix system, and mess up there. So I would say, you know, this is probably going to be picked up by more contemporary criminal gangs, and we could definitely start seeing this, either this direct idea in more garden variety malware or some derivation of it for data stealing or for, let's say, rooting or defacing websites. And we know, for instance, that mass defacements of websites are very popular and very profitable, and also the trending towards the watering hole. One can see how this may provide a fairly innocuous and silent vector to infect some administrator's Windows PC and then silently start compromising websites and uploading custom Apache modules and inserting iframes and that sort of thing. So I think there's definitely an important lesson here. You know, while we don't know how this thing propagates, we can probably be pretty sure that it uses one of the normal run-of-the-mill methods, either phishing or USB or watering hole or some fundamentally new network-based vulnerability that we're not aware of yet. But the thing that we can be certain of is that it's a really terrible idea to store your passwords cached in those profiles of any SSH terminal applications. So if you happen to be someone who does that, hopefully this is your warning to go and remove those. So as far as attribution goes, the general consensus is that this is being done by a hacking group known as Whois, and they know that pretty well because at the same time as the malware outbreak was happening, there were quite a few DDoS attacks and apparently some website compromises. And there's a number of screenshots popping around on the internet showing hacked pages that have the Whois hacking team logo. Now, there is a very strong suspicion that it's actually North Korea behind the actual attacks, because of the political situation between the North and the South there. Now, interestingly, there was a bit of a stir last week when there was apparently some forensics that traced back some of the virus activity to a Chinese IP address. And a little bit later, it was uncovered that that was a big mistake, because the internal network that was being analyzed was actually IP'd using external IP addresses that happen to also reside in China. And so, you know, instead of using a RFC 1918 address space, you know, 192.168 type address space, they were using legitimate IP addresses of some Chinese NetBlack. And so in the forensics, it certainly looked like some Chinese system was involved, when in fact that was just an internal IP address. So, you know, if you're going to be renumbering your network or setting up an organization's network, don't do that. The forensics people have enough problems as it is, adding some level of obscurity like that really just makes their jobs a nightmare. And it really doesn't buy you anything, and probably at some point will just cause some problems. So I realize people listening to this podcast likely aren't in the role to do that, but if you are in an organization who does that or is considering doing that, you might want to have a talk with your network team. Okay, the last story for this week is a fantastic series of articles by a gentleman named Mark Baggett. And he gave this speech at ShmooCon, and I first saw this by looking at the videos from ShmooCon, and apparently he started up a four-part article series on SANS. And I really think it's worth spending some time talking about here. The concept is that if your computer or if a computer becomes compromised with malware, there's too many variables, too many ways for an attacker to maintain persistence to make it worthwhile trying to clean. Mark's proposal is that if you do have a situation where a computer becomes infected with malware or compromised, it needs to be wiped clean and reinstalled. And so to illustrate the point, he gives a number of examples of how persistence can be achieved even after a system has been cleaned, the memory's been analyzed, the file system's been analyzed, and declared clean. So the first method he describes is called file association hijacking. And so if you keep the context in mind that we have had a computer, let's say a Windows system, compromised with some malware, or maybe the malware was a remote access Trojan, something like that, and some knowledgeable attacker had an opportunity to have his way with the system, the good guys come in, the Geek Squad cleans the malware, they run Malwarebytes and a few other tools, and they clean off the system, maybe even some highly paid forensic analysts come in and take a memory dump and determine that we've got the malware off, there's nothing left. So what an attacker can do is create a file association with, let's say, in Mark's example, he gives a text file. So you change the association of a .txt extension over to a custom application that you drop on the system that basically is a wrapper around Notepad. And at some time in the future, somebody opens a .txt application or a .txt file, Notepad goes to run, and instead of running notepad.exe, the custom wrapper script runs instead, launches the piece of malware, maybe pulling something down from the internet, what have you, as well as opening up Notepad to make it look legitimate. And now the system is infected again. And you might be asking the question, well, hey, wouldn't antivirus detect that wrapper script? And the answer is probably not. It's pretty easy to actually get around antivirus. And I don't think a lot of people really are aware of how easy that is. That's probably a topic for another podcast, though. The second technique Mark describes is using the Bits backdoor. Bits is a Windows service that is used to download Windows updates in the background. So I think it stands for Background Intelligent Transfer Service, if memory serves. So once on a system, an attacker can schedule a job with the Bits engine to download a new bit of malware and launch it after it's been run. So again, the system's been cleaned, but the attacker has had an opportunity to tell Bits to go and download a piece of malware at a certain date and then run it. Now your system's back to infected again. All right, the next technique is using a very old weakness with the way Windows handles spaces in file paths. So basically, the long and the short of it is you can create a bit of malware with the name c:/program.exe, and it will be run at some point when some application tries to run something in the program files directory. It's just a very old weakness. This thing is older than the hills. Hopefully most people are aware of it, but believe it or not, it's still kicking around. But again, program.exe gets run, your system's back to infected. All right, the next avenue for persistence is using service recovery startup options. In the services control panel, you can actually define custom recovery services for when a service fails. And that's so you can do different things, you know, based on a certain service failing. You might want to collect logs and upload logs or what have you, but you can also, as a malicious person, append some malicious command or a bit of malware that's resident on the system to start running again when a system fails. And you can either do that using some service that you know fails pretty reliably, let's say your antivirus engine, or you can use some service that you're, as an attacker, comfortable that you can actually cause to fail, let's say remote desktop services, by using one of the old denial of service vulnerabilities that hasn't been patched yet, because hey, it's just a denial of service vulnerability and nobody really patches those because they're not all that important. So the service fails, the malware runs, and we're back to infected again. The next opportunity for persistence is, I will say, probably the coolest by far that I've seen, and that's creating a trigger based on an ETW. And an ETW is event tracing for Windows. And so this allows you, as an administrator, to define triggers based on different events in a system. So you can create a trigger if a certain domain name is looked up. You can create a trigger if a certain wireless network is connected to. You can create a trigger for just a whole bunch of different things. And actually, I'll say this is, again, probably one of the more nefarious opportunities, because you could, say, have a piece of malware not run when it's attached to a company's network. It can only run if it's attached to, let's say, a Starbucks or a home network or something like that, where maybe they don't have the level of exfiltration controls or network controls that might detect your activity. But again, the net is you can define, as an attacker, some trigger and have a piece of malware that's resident on the system, and again, not detected by antivirus, run upon, you know, the criteria of your trigger. The opportunities are pretty endless, at least it seems that way to me. The next option for an attacker is to attach a custom debugger to an executable. I think this is a lot more complicated to exploit as an attacker, but again, it's another relatively obscure, fairly deep avenue that some attacker could actually use, which would probably be something that most people wouldn't actually think to check for. The next opportunity is actually pretty cool and ingenious, and that's creating a custom win logon event. And rather than executing on login, you're actually executing this on shutdown. So you're actually infecting the system while the system is being shut down during a time period when a forensics person doesn't have the opportunity to be looking at memory or realistically analyzing what's happening on the disk. Now, certainly there's caveats to that, like in virtualized environments and certain test harness apparatus. But you know, for a general PC, this is pretty clever. So the system gets cleaned, looks good, it gets shut down. When it gets started back up, it is infected again. And the last method is using scheduled tasks. And as I mentioned earlier with the South Korea bit, which used scheduled tasks, this gives you, as an attacker, an opportunity to explicitly state a date and time to execute a particular task. And on a given system, there's lots of scheduled tasks, and it can be difficult to tell if something is legitimate or not legitimate, so an attacker can use that to their advantage. In Mark's paper, he goes on and takes it a couple steps farther and says, well, what happens if we have this kind of capability in an Active Directory domain environment? Maybe we mix a few of these kinds of things together, and we can, you know, for instance, create scheduled tasks across the domain and set up some custom events for a particular service account, which really should never see invalid logons because the passwords are set not to expire. But let's say we set a custom event for when a failed logon is seen on that, and that triggers an event to create a new account with a different password, one known by the attacker. So again, that creates an avenue into the network and says, hey, you know, if you have a domain environment that gets compromised, especially if it's possible that the attackers have compromised some domain level admin credentials, you know, you really have to think long and hard about what your response is going to be from a domain perspective. The guidance is pretty clear from a workstation perspective. If your system gets compromised, you know, given the totality of what an attacker can do to maintain persistence even after you've cleaned it, that says you're really only left with an option to reinstall that system. But what about a domain? If your domain becomes compromised, does that in turn mean that you need to rebuild your domain? And, you know, in a large environment, that is a massive undertaking. But again, if you don't, how do you know that you have closed all the doors? There's one more thing I wanted to talk about, and that is security awareness education. Bruce Schneier last week released a post on Dark Reading about the lack of value in investing in security awareness education. I actually posted a article on defensivesecurity.org about it, and I partly agree with it and I partly disagree with it. The fundamental argument that he and a number of other people in the industry have is that people really shouldn't be counted as part of your control set. You need to be defining security protections that don't require people to know what to do and what not to do. And I definitely am a proponent of that where it is possible. So a great example is passwords. You know, we all try to instill in our people, our employees, our constituents, how important it is to choose a good password. But you know, time and time again, we know that people pick bad passwords. So there seems to be a bit of a disconnect between how much we train people and their likelihood of actually using good passwords. So we're forced in that case to make sure our applications require good passwords or use something fundamentally different like two-factor authentication. And we have to do that because we know that, again, people aren't going to pick good passwords, either because they're not aware of what a good password is, or because they're too busy at the moment to pick a good password, or some number of other reasons. But in other areas, there aren't opportunities for controls. You know, a good example is phishing in emails. I can't tell you over my career how many times people have told me that that are just shocked when I tell them that, you know, they need to be careful what they click on. Their response is, you know, fairly dumbfounded that though we have antivirus, viruses are able to make it through into their inbox. And that was Dave Itell's point on his podcast with Ryan Narine last week. You know, we need to be building systems where people can click wherever they want. They shouldn't be forced to not click on certain buttons because that might be bad. And in a utopic view of the world, I absolutely agree with that. However, we don't live in that utopia right now. I do agree that there are some technologies that will enable us to get a little closer. However, especially in very large organizations, those things are just not practical to deploy. Things like application waitlisting. You know, if you have 100,000 people, the overhead to manage that becomes gargantuan, and we're back to actually relying on people knowing not to click on things. So my perspective on the debate is really figuring out how to divide those things that should be implemented as technical controls so that people don't have to think about it from those things like phishing and social engineering, where we don't have effective technical controls, or maybe you, in your organization, you do have effective controls and actually need to worry about something else. So anyway, again, there's a article on my defensivesecurity.org page. If you want to read that, that's interesting. It's got a link to the Bruce Schneier article. With that, I'm actually going to close it down for the week. I wish you all a great coming week. I know it's going to be a long weekend next week for lots of people. I hope you all enjoy. There should be a podcast next Sunday. I look forward to talking to you all again next week. Again, if you have any feedback, please send me an email at info@defensivesecurity.org or on Twitter @DefensiveSec. Have a great week, and I will talk to you next time. Bye.